Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me and Lee Boyce today is Helen Crane. And coming up, Happy New Year, everybody. Well, not if you sell old clothes and the like. HMRC could be coming after you. Also today, HSBC announces their latest mortgage rate cuts, including a sub 4%. Lenders keep cutting. But will a fall in rates drive up house prices? Tis the season for divorce. We tell you how you can try to make a clean and fair financial break, and we share our money lessons, reminders, and tips from 2023. Don't forget you stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, have you ever sold anything on Etsy or Vinted or Facebook Marketplace just to make a bit of extra cash? Well, now the tax man could be after you. HMRC has started cracking down on online resellers who fail to declare their income through digital platforms. So will anyone doing a clear out, selling unwanted gifts, be stung with additional taxes? Lee, you wrote the book on how never to go broke. And I'm pretty sure there might have been a section or two. It's been a couple of years since I read it, sorry. There might have been a section or two about reselling. Are you just walking into a tax trap?
Well, this story, Georgie, this is not the new year I was expecting the story to sort of have blown up this week. But I said Happy New Year, by the way. Sorry, I forgot to say that as we started. This really did the rounds this week. It's social media. It sort of caught a light. It went viral. Lots of people very upset that the tax man is looking like it's targeting, you know, basically just everyday people that might be having an attic clear out. They might be, you know, selling old books, all that kind of stuff. People just were quite upset about it. So before I wade into this, I've got a few thoughts about this. So first of all, I think that anything that's done to make sure that people aren't avoiding tax is not a bad thing, right? First of all. But second of all, this does feel quite big brother. So what this is that essentially these apps, these platforms will now automatically report to HMRC. These are not new tax rules. These are not kind of new rules per se whatsoever, because they were on the cards. We wrote about it a couple of times last year that this was coming down the line, and then this month it's happened. But it's the automatic reporting into HMRC about it. And I think what people are kind of upset about is the fact that if you think about, you know, for example, some of the massive global companies that are in this a country that perhaps don't pay their fair share of tax, you know, you've got massive, massive juggernauts of companies that you could argue aren't paying a fair share. And then you've just got Mrs. Miggins down the road who, you know, has to kind of like have her selling life sort of intrinsic looked at. And let's face it, in recent years, more and more of us have been doing this. And it's a good thing. You know, we have accumulated so much stuff, so many items, and the more we can avoid from going into landfill, the better. You know that. I fished my daughter's third birthday present out of a skip. You know, it was a princess bike. We've had this conversation.
I love
saving things from the scrap heap, you know, and giving them another life rather than, you know, they're just going to landfill. But I think there's been a lot of confusion around this. First of all, as I say, it's not a new tax. Everyone has a £1,000 limit, this trading allowance. It's called Dob, the trading allowance, right? So you don't need to worry about it if you are selling items under that value, which I would presume is the vast majority of people who are getting upset about this. So the way I understand it is that firms will only pass on data to the tax man automatically if you're selling 30 or more items a year or have total earnings over the equivalent of 2,000 euros, which is about £1,700.
Right.
So that's quite the key piece of information there. So essentially, you can probably sell two or three items a month and not have to worry about it whatsoever. I think what they're trying to do is crack down on the kind of people that have maybe made a kind of business out of this, almost accidentally, if you like, because they've got good at doing it and they've got good at spotting things that they could flip around for a profit. Perhaps they've read Never Go Broke, but they might not quite realise that they are going over a certain threshold. Or they do know that they're going over it and they're kind of thinking, well, who's going to come and crack down on this? And then there's loads of grey areas around it, without a doubt, plenty of grey areas around it. And also, let's face it, how good are the HMRC going to be at cracking down at people that are going to be just around about those levels? You know, I think they'll be focusing on, especially in the first instance, on people that are perhaps turning over 5, 10, 15 grand in this kind of like side hustle type of way, and going after them. And it's not just your eBays, your Etsys, your Vinted, and all of that kind of thing. If you're renting out your renting out a home on Airbnb, if you're getting extra income from being a Deliveroo rider or Uber rider, these are all now going to be automatically sent over to the tax man. So it's not just about selling items, it's also about these other kind of like sort of side, I hate the word side hustle, but these kind of like side
Additional income.
additional income that people are perhaps getting and not declaring. And the whole argument there is, well, you know, potentially if you're earning an income and it's going over certain thresholds, then you should be paying tax on it. And I don't think you could begrudge HMRC for doing that. I think what people have kind of got in a panic about is just thinking about, I sell some of these items. Am I going to be involved in this? I've already paid tax on it because I bought clothes from a shop. There's already, you know, VAT on it or whatever. And now I've paid all the tax on that. So why am I now having to be taxed on it again? And I just can't see a kind of scenario in which that will happen. And I'll talk about grey areas. I don't understand either. So let's take clothes, for instance, right? Let's say you've got an eye for spotting dresses in charity shops, right? You can find a designer shop in a charity shop for a fiver, and then you can sell it on Vinted for 50 quid. Now, I don't know that the key probably is now to keep more of a kind of record of what you're doing and more of an inventory list. If you're someone that does this as more of a kind of sales hobby, is to say, right, I bought this dress from Oxfam on the 4th of January for £5, and then I sold it on eBay for £50. And then you probably just have to keep a bit of a log on it, just in case anything comes back to bite you, is probably my best piece of advice. But I don't think it really, really needs to frighten many people that sort of casually sell on these sites.
I'm always the eternal optimist, and I think that actually most people just wouldn't even think about it, Helen. That, hang on a minute, like you say, I've paid my VAT, I bought these clothes, better than going to a charity shop where only a tenth of stuff is sold and the rest is sent to other countries or landfill, you know? So I kind of just think that this is why the story blew up, because I just genuinely don't think people realize. But Helen, do you think £1,000 is too low? Because what if you're having a big clear out? And actually, your stuff may go over a grand. As Lee says, look, it's great. It means this stuff gets used again. You earn a little bit of extra money at a difficult time. Should we not just say, look, make it 5 grand or something? How many people honestly go over the £1,000? But now people will think twice about doing it.
Yeah, you're right. Probably not a lot of people will go over that limit. But it, you know, as you said, if you are having a big house clear out, you know, you might have a few bits of furniture, some old clothes, and things like that can add up. And you know, a lot of people sell things like old phones on eBay, which can go for a few £100. So, yeah, it's definitely not conceivable that quite a few people could go over the limit. But I think what muddies the waters even more, and as you said, these rules are really confusing. You know, we as financial journalists have found them, you know, quite hard to get to the bottom of. You know, normal people, I don't really know what hope they have. But it seems to be this issue around whether you're a trader or not. And that's not a kind of cut and dry thing.
Explain. What
So,
do you mean by that?
well, so HMRC has these rules. So it seems to me that they're essentially saying perhaps even if you sold more than £1,000 worth of stuff, if you weren't classed as a trader, then you might still not be liable for tax, seems to be what the rules are saying to me. And there's these six kind of criteria which HMRC will look at when they're deciding whether or not you're a trader. But it's all kind of quite subjective. It's basically if the worst did happen and you were pulled up for selling stuff on eBay, they would look at these as the nine badges of trade. Sorry, I think I said six before, that decide whether you're a trader. So these are profit-seeking motive, the number of transactions, the nature of the asset, existence of similar trading transactions or interest, changes to the asset, the way the sale was carried out, the source of finance, the amount of time between the purchase and the sale, and the method of acquisition. I mean, first of all, who is going to remember all of those things if they're just selling an old dress on eBay? Like, are you going to remember the sort of where you got the money from to buy that dress? Are you going to remember how long it's been between when you bought it and when you sold it? I mean, people just aren't going to be keeping a record of these things. As Lee said, it's something if you do sell a lot, you should possibly be looking to do from now on. But there's no way that people who sell old stuff on eBay are going to have a record of whether they like fit the 9 badges of trade. It's, yeah, it's something that people are completely sort of unprepared for. Maybe there is a case for upping the limit. But I think, you know, if it's just a one-off thing, if you're selling 1,000 miles worth of stuff every year, clearly, you know, there is an argument that you should rightfully be sort of paying tax on that. But one big clear out, should that really, land you with a tax bill? I think probably not.
Lee, there's no point in arguing whether we should have it or shouldn't have it or whatever. It is what it is. So what should you be doing if you want to be a responsible online seller that's just doing a bit on the side, you may be creeping over, you're not sure? Actually, just generally, because some people will be listening to this going, I have never sold anything. Like, I've got a bike, Lee, that I actually found on the side. I didn't, but someone found it and then gave it to me. It said, please take this bike. We didn't just steal it, right? But I've never used it. I'm not a cyclist. There's just no way it's worth it. You know, I like my life and my limbs where they are. So it's just sat there in my hallway for a year and a half. Really annoying. What do I do with it? Get me started, Lee.
That's a New Year's resolution right there, Georgie. I think you need to get yourself a helmet, get yourself on the high visibility stuff and not be afraid to be getting out and cycling in your local area.
No way. It's not happening. No way. Just no way. It's not happening.
Well, look,
I've also got a dress. It's worth £400. It sat in my thing for about 3 years. I think I went to a do with you, Lee, and I sat next to you in it. It's the only time I ever wore it. It's a gold dress. It's too much for me. What do I do with a £400? I didn't pay £400. Nowhere near that. But what do I do with that, Lee? Tell me.
You look dazzling in that, Georgie.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you.
I can't remember what you're talking about. I'm sure you looked a million bucks. I'll tell you that much. So, with the bike, I'm a casual. I would describe myself as a casual seller, right? Especially over the not so much in the last year, but kind of at the beginning of the pandemic in that first year. Had a daughter that was growing from sort of baby to toddler to, you know, toddler teenager pretty quickly. And some of those items, I'd rather they had a new home, didn't sell them for huge amounts of money. I mean, these are things that I'm losing money on because I bought them for X amount and then I'm selling them for X amount. And I just sold them on Facebook Marketplace and always made it part of my day. So I made sure that it wasn't a weekend or it would just be time, organize a sale when I'm in, right? And someone just comes and gives you the cash. You do not need to be thinking about declaring that. You're not a trader. That's not the real kind of thing to think about here, is whether you're a trader or not. Are you purposely going out and buying things to sell on for a profit, or are you selling old things from around your home that you'd already bought at probably max price or secondhand, and you're just selling it on again? If you're in that latter category, very unlikely that you're going to fall into that sort of basket. So for that bike, probably the only way you're going to sell that is on Facebook Marketplace, I would imagine, because you're not going to sell it on eBay. I mean, I'm not a big eBay lover, like all of the kind of posts.
Why?
I'm just not very good at organizing, like getting all of the kind of, you know, postage bags and all that kind of stuff. It just isn't for me. I'd rather that someone comes to my doorstep, hands me over the cash, and it's done, right?
Okay.
It's done. Yeah, I know you're looking at me like I'm mad.
Can I meet in a secret place?
No, I'm fine. Like, you know, most of the time, people are pretty good. Everyone I've ever sold on Facebook Marketplace has been very good. They've been true to the word. They've come around with some cash and it's been fine. But I understand there is, to be careful. And also, Facebook Marketplace, as we've been talking about in the last year, has become a hotbed of fraud. I mean, you have to be super careful. And definitely, I wouldn't be making any payments or accepting any payments. It doesn't have a payment system. So that's the big issue with it. But I'm happy just to take cash over the head. That's what I like to do. It's fine. I'm not selling more than 30 items a year. Most people who are listening to this probably aren't either. Now, in terms of your dress, it's quite likely that you're probably not going to get the best price for it on Facebook Marketplace because it's quite a small pool of people because you're selling more for the local area. So you're probably going to take that to something like Vinted.
Right.
And you're going to take some nice photographs of it and you're going to list it for however much you deem acceptable. Now, I'm not a Vinted user either. I know Helen is. And I know people like to lowball on Vinted a lot. I think that's
it's a new one for me, Vinted. It's not, it's new, isn't it? Or
It's newish, yeah. I mean,
heard of it, but
it's been around for a fair few years. But it's a newish kid on the block. Yeah, I know what you mean. I know where you're coming from. Yeah, it's not like it's not an eBay. It's like a more of a kind of recent phenomenon. But again, it just depends, Georgie. I mean, if you're just selling that dress as a one-off thing, you don't need to worry about it. You know, if you're selling 30 dresses, you don't really need to worry about it. It's whether or not you've gone out and bought those dresses, as far as I understand it, with the view to selling them on for a profit. AKA, you're a trader. So a good example of this is, let's say furniture, right? Quite a lot of people these days are furniture flippers. We've written about this in the last year as well, because I think it's a really interesting little area of kind of resale, right? You might see some furniture out on the street, says free, take me. And some people are very good at loading that into a van, polishing it all up, treating it and decorating it and making it look really nice, and selling that as a bespoke piece of furniture for, you know, a not insignificant sum of money. You are looking to that. That is you being a trader. You are trading that. You are looking to sell that on for a profit. If you've just got some furniture in your attic, or you're cleaning out, getting rid of your dining room table, and you're selling that on Facebook Marketplace or whatever, you're not a trader. That is what I think, how to think about it. Are you a trader, or are you just a casual seller that's getting rid of some of the stuff around the home? And I think if you're in that latter category, you've got nothing to worry about, as far as I understand it.
My God, Lee, if you don't understand it, how can any of us? All right, fine. That's it. That's going to be my new mission for this year. I'm going to reread Never Go Broke, and I'm going to try and stay within the tax limits and sell that dress from, I think it was 2018 I last wore it. Anyway, what's going on in the housing market? Let's go there, shall we? That's my other thing for this year, buying a house. HSBC have announced the latest mortgage rate cuts, including a sub 4%, as Halifax House Price Index for December, and indeed for 2023 overall, shows prices are up. It all comes as investors are betting on six rate cuts from the Bank of England this year. Good news for borrowers, but could all this spell a rise in house prices even further? Helen, what's going on? Firstly, mortgage rate cuts. Lots of talk about that. What's going on?
So we're four working days into 2024, and we've had an absolute raft of lenders cutting mortgage rates already. So NatWest, First Direct, TSB, Empowered Mortgages all announced cuts to their mortgage rates yesterday. Earlier in the week, as you said, HSBC and Halifax cut their rates. So, straight out the gates in the year, cutting mortgage rates. And what's getting everyone a bit excited is that we now have 5-year fixed rates below 4%. So last year, when mortgage rates spiked around the summer, a lot of experts were saying, you know, they'll go down a bit from here, but we're probably not going to see fixes below 4% for, you know, maybe for even years. And they've been proving it wrong, because that has happened. We've now got HSBC have got 3.94% on a 5-year fix, a couple of others coming in below that 4% mark, and on 2-year fixes, the best deals are looking around 4.5%. So it's better than people expected, and kind of lower than people expected they will go at this point. So that's really good news for people who are looking to move, or to people who need to remortgage. You know, obviously people have been quite worried. Anyone with a remortgage deadline coming up, they might have thought a few months ago that they'd be looking at a rate of 5 or even 6%, and they're now coming down. So that is positive. Of course, rates are still nowhere near as low as they were a couple of years ago, but it does seem like things are moving in the right direction. And as you said, that's because of these more sort of positive expectations around where the base rate is going to go. So the forecasts now are that by the end of this year, the base rate could go down as low as 3.75%. And that's kind of what's bringing mortgage rates down partly. You know, lenders are saying by the end of the year, our costs of providing these mortgages are going to be lower, so we can afford to make our mortgages a bit cheaper. They also want to draw in new customers, because as we all know, the housing market has been really quite sluggish for the last few months. You know, as you said, Halifax has recorded a bit of a bump in house prices. So they've said that over the course of 2023, they went up 1.7%. A lot of people thought they would fall. Some people are predicting a massive crash. That obviously didn't happen. But when you compare that to, you know, previous years, the year coming out of the pandemic, House prices went up by like 14%. So compared to that, it has been really sluggish. And we've seen people putting off moving and things like that over the last year. So, you know, these cheaper mortgage rates could kind of give the housing market a bit of a shot in the arm going into 2024.
Lee, have I missed something? Quite possibly. I can't keep up. I thought pretty confident the Bank of England have been pretty sturdy. Look, we are not going to cut rates, and then boom, all of a sudden 6 rate cuts next year. That's a lot. What's happened?
Yeah, it is a lot. Well, I think sort of towards the tail end of last year, we had the inflation figures. You know, a kind of, it feels like the kind of quite quick rises in base rate are having the effect that policymakers are hoping for, essentially. And now, you know, we're looking at the sort of markets here, this story suggesting that there's going to be 6 cuts this year. Now, the thing is with predictions, as we know, it's just impossible to kind of really know how accurate it's going to be. But it gives a good flavour of where, you know, the kind of speculators expect base rate to be heading. Now, the reason I was kind of smirking there and also chuckling when I said the word predictions, it's about house prices. I mean, if you told me this time last year that house prices were going to have recorded a modest rise over the course of 2023, I think I might have been like, that's not what anyone is saying. That is not what any forecasters, from the big major lenders to the little guys who run their Twitter accounts and say doom is coming, the whole spectrum really did have modest to relatively big falls penciled in for this year. And then we have Halifax this morning saying that house prices actually went up 1.7% in 2023. And that's despite, you know, the number of house sales being down quite a lot. I think they're down about a fifth. And mortgage rates obviously far higher than what we've been used to, what we've been accustomed to in the last decade or so. So, I mean, that is quite a sizable piece of news in my mind. I mean, I cannot believe it. I really cannot believe it. And it just shows you that you do have to take these predictions and things with a complete and utter vat of salt, because it's just, you know, quite remarkable. But what we're seeing now, you know, I think with the kind of looking at the prices of markets and looking at a base rate that might potentially be 3.75% by the end of the year, we're seeing mortgage lenders, especially the major ones, starting to reprice what they're doing to try and kind of stimulate competition, stimulate getting customers in. And it's good news for borrowers. I mean, especially if you kind of fix, for example, 5 years in 2021, the start of 2022, you're probably going to potentially be riding out quite a large part of the storm. And to be having rates now at below 4%, it's quite good. And there's even 10-year fixes at 4%, below 4%. I mean, not that I would recommend fixing for 10 years. Very niche product. Some people will like it for the stability, but very, very, very niche product. But it's all little chinks of light and signs of things going in a direction that people will be happy about. But what has happened is the detriment of savers. Savers rates have been kind of collapsing all around us at the same time. But, you know, it's probably a bit more of a kind of balance now of you know, mortgage rates that are higher than what they once were, savings rates far higher than what they were a couple of years ago.
Quite. I'm glad you said about sort of taking with a pinch of salt predictions as well, because I've just had a push notification on my phone about how traders are suggesting that, or pricing in 4 cuts to around 4% by the end of the year. So who knows?
It's going to be 5 cuts. We're meeting the middle.
Yeah, you reckon? Maybe. Could be. But Helen, one of the questions that people will, of course, be asking themselves at this time, if you're coming up for remortgage, do you not potentially go for 10 years, but 2 or 5? Because I think the vast majority of people are opting for the short-term option at the moment. What is the advice? I mean, you can go for a 10, I mean, whatever, but at least outlined why there may be a few issues with that. Go short or long term?
So there's been a bit of a flip around in terms of people's preferences on 2 or 5 years over the last couple of years. You know, it used to be years ago that most people would go for a 2-year, I think, because they tended to be a bit cheaper and people kind of thought, oh, you know, 5 years seems like a really long time. 2 years, maybe a bit of a better bet. But when a couple of years ago, when we saw those really, really low mortgage rates, people on, you know, in some cases, less than 1%, a lot of people kind of got used to a 5-year fix. They thought, yeah, you know, if I'm fixing in at you know, 1.2% for 5 years. Surely it can't get much better than this. So people kind of came around to the idea of a 5-year fix, thinking that, you know, I mean, you'd almost have been mad not to fix the 5 years at a rate that low, although some people still didn't. But then obviously when mortgage rates flipped back the other way and we saw really high rates, people were then, this was towards the sort of, well, for a large part of 2022, people thought, you know, well, I'm not, why would I fix in for 5 years at 6%? I'll fix for 2 years with the hope that by the time they come around to remortgaging, hopefully rates will be lower. Now with rates going down a little bit again, that question has become a bit trickier. But I think most people do still tend to be opting for 2 years just because it is so uncertain. As Lee said, with house prices, it's also, it's still tricky to predict what might happen to mortgage rates. I mean, generally, yes, it seems like the base rate is going to go down and they're going to go down. But then look at the mini budget. No one expected that. And mortgage rates absolutely rocketed. So there is a sense of you never really know. And some people might just prefer to stay on that shorter fix just so they can, you know, they always had the option to get out. It's a difficult one, but I would say 5 years don't look like such a bad idea at the minute with rates potentially coming round to, you know, 4%. I do still think, I've said this for a while, and I do still think that we're not going to see really, really low rates of kind of less than 2% probably for quite some time. So does it look like an absolutely terrible idea to lock in 5 years at 4%? No, not necessarily. It also gives you that certainty. You know, if you're someone that wants to say, I can afford my mortgage at this rate comfortably, I'm happy to pay that for 5 years, I don't need to worry about it, I know that that's within my budget and I can forget about my mortgage until, you know, 2029, then that's not necessarily a bad option.
Lee, I do have to ask you though, look, Helen pointed out there, we've had some quite a few years of it, haven't we? It's been all over the shop. And when the economy generally is slightly all over the shop, we do like to go for a bit of security and we view houses as security. So as rates are dropping, are we going to see people plough in? Which again, look, rates coming down, great for those people who have a mortgage. House prices going up, not great for those who are trying to get on the property ladder. Do you think that's likely? As rates drop, house prices could rise again? They already have.
Well, they already have. And I think the thing is, I can't, look, I'm not, you know, I'm not making predictions here, Georgie. But I guess my hunch is that it will just, I think house prices will just remain stable. I think is probably what I would say. You know, and it shows you the danger of, if you are someone that's looking to get on a property ladder or make a move, of just sort of dawdling and thinking, oh, okay, well, at the start of the year, everyone's telling me that house prices are going to fall, so I'll wait, and this year house prices are going to fall, so I'll get more bang for my buck. And then house prices went up 1.7% this year. So I think it's just like, if you're in a position to do it and you feel confident in doing so, you just got to go for it. But, and I don't think it's helpful, people like Howard Davis this morning saying on BBC Radio 4 that it's not that difficult at the moment to get on the property ladder. I mean, things like that are just sort of like, well, hold on a sec. You know, how out of touch of reality are you to be saying things like that? But I think, crucially, you just can't time the market. I think that is true in lots of different areas of our personal finances, and none so more than British house prices, that are basically like a cockroach. You just can't stamp it, you know, and it'll never wriggle and die. You know, it's like, they just seem to be quite stable. And with mortgage rates coming lower, we're still not building enough homes. And the homes that we are building, lots of people just aren't buying them at the moment. And that's helping, you know, the good quality homes are still selling, and they have been selling, maybe at a slightly slower rate last year, but they're still selling. And my final parting shot really on this is, if you have remortgaged or you are a first-time buyer, especially if you've kind of got the deal in the sort of 6 months ago, 3 months ago, depending on your lender, quite often you can just go and switch to another deal if the rates have been coming down. So you might want to investigate whether or not, if you are someone, let's say 2-3 months ago, you remortgaged, you got X rate, but it hasn't kicked in yet, you might be able to phone up your lender and say, actually, you're now offering this rate, and usually they will grant it to you. So definitely investigate that if you fall into that boat. And if you're in the other side of that, you are due to remortgage within the next 6 months. You know, you can always take agree one of these lower rates that have come in. And if rates do continue to fall in a few months' time, the possibility is you might be able to switch to an even lower rate. It just gives you that kind of like stability and knowledge that, you know, you've got this 4% rate, say. And actually, I should also point this out. The 4% rates, the sub 4% rates, are for people with 60% LTV, right? These are 40% deposit mortgages, people that have built equity in their homes largely. So when we're saying sub 4%, although the gap between rates between the sort of 90% LTV and 60% LTV has narrowed quite a lot, but those very best rates are reserved for the people that have built up the most equity in their homes or have massive deposits, is that, you know, it could be worth just locking that in. Well, you're not even locking it. You're getting it and you're going to have it if you want it. But then if things improve even more by March, by April, you could potentially move on to an even better rate. So you're not missing out. And I think that that is definitely something worth considering, worth investigating. It takes a couple of minutes to phone up your lender and find out.
That's it for part one.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
Welcome back. The first working Monday of the new year is Divorce Day. Lovely. It's when the Christmas straw breaks the unhappy camel's back, leading many to formally start the process of splitting up. So how can you have a clean and fair financial break? Divorce Day, Helen. Absolutely delightful.
Yeah, it's not the jolliest kind of thought, is it? But basically, people just get absolutely sick of each other, don't they, after Christmas. I can see it, you know. If you're kind of on the rocks, sadly, Christmas can sort of push people over the edge. You know, you're spending a lot of time at home. And you might just think,
in-laws,
all these things. You might just think, do you know what? I cannot stand this person, and decide to, fire the starting gun on your divorce. But you know, divorce not always bad, can be a good thing if you're not happy. You know, that's
true.
Let's put a positive spin on some of these divorces. Might be a good idea.
Yeah, look, whatever, you know, it's your decision is your decision. However, let's try and talk about how you can make this as clean process as possible. And I think people think that once you get divorced, that's it, the finances are all settled. But that's not the case. You actually have to go through settlement and get all of that sorted out. So just explain to us the financy aspect of it, obviously. But if you are going through a divorce, I'm really sorry. It's a horrible process, I'm sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, one thing to mention is that in 2022, there was this new legislation, this no-fault divorce system, which means that it should actually be quicker and easier to get divorced. You know, there's not as much kind of hoops to jump through. You should, in theory, be able to make more of a clean break. But that's the sort of legal process. And obviously, the finances, as you said, can be much more kind of entangled, and it can be much more difficult to work out how things are split up. So one in five divorces recently were delayed for money reasons, according to LNG. So, you know, this is still one of the biggest issues when it comes to separating. Obviously, one of the big things to talk about is what happens to your family home, especially if you have children. That can obviously be a really tricky issue. And actually, that links into high mortgage rates. So say if you're separating and one partner staying in the home, the other partner has to go out and find their own new place. Maybe they want to buy. High mortgage rates make that a lot more complicated, because the person is going off on their own. They might now find it more difficult to qualify for a mortgage as a single person. So that's one kind of complication that people who are separating should sort of bear in mind at the moment. Do you want to, can one person keep your house? Obviously, there's an emotional attachment, especially as said, if you've got a family, but it doesn't always necessarily make financial sense. You know, if one person takes the home, it normally means that the other person gets kind of priority over the majority of the other assets, because obviously the property is normally the most valuable. So it's something that's definitely worth kind of considering, getting advice on what's the best way forward for you and how can you kind of split things fairly.
You talked about the house being the biggest asset, but actually sometimes combined together, your pension could be as big.
Yeah, exactly. Kind of surprising, the article we've got on this, we say that only 12% of divorces have a pension sharing order, which is kind
of... Wow!
Yeah, exactly. It's something that does seem to get missed, especially people doing these kind of DIY divorces, maybe not necessarily thought about. But pensions can be massively important, especially if you're in a couple where, say, one person has taken some time off to raise children and, you know, they've had time where they weren't contributing to their pension. Then, you know, there's an argument that any sort of pension income that the other person made during that time should be equally shared, you know, if one partner was contributing to kind of raising the family. So it's really, really vital that you do talk about how to split your pension. There's three ways to do it. So you can share them on a sort of a clean break basis, which is essentially, you know, you each keep your own pension. One partner can earmark some of their income to be paid to their ex-spouse after they retire. Or the other option is to kind of offset the value of one of the pensions against other assets. So you basically make a deal where one person gets more pension income, the other person perhaps gets to keep the property. You know, you kind of work it out based on whatever assets are in there. So yeah, again, very very good idea to kind of get advice on how best to split your pension and think about, you know, your finances will probably change when you when you retire, you know, based on your new kind of single status. You know, how is that, you know, try and look forward to your retirement and think about how the divorce will affect what you thought you might have and what you now might have. It's really important to kind of look forward and think about how that might impact your retirement.
Well, I was going to say, Lee, how do you... That's sorted out. Thank you very much, Helen. That's sorted out how to have a kind of clean financial break. But then it's about starting a new financial life. How do you go about doing that in your 40s, your 50s, your 60s?
Well, actually, a really good point Heather made. In the start of 2022, there were these sort of quickie divorce rules that came in that kind of made it easier and speedier, basically, to get a divorce. But experts are warning that for that reason, acting in haste, there could be sort of money decisions that are kind of being sort of not thought about or done properly. I know we said this before. Actually, Helen and I were in the office yesterday deciding what should go in the podcast today. And we divorced there, and we both went, really, should we do divorce? Is it? But it's such an important topic for people to try and get their head around. And I think the number one thing, and I know this is easier said than done, but it's just keeping it amicable, isn't it? And trying to make sure that you're both going to be, you know, set up to start a new life separately. You know, lots of things get tangled together, lots of your assets, lots of your finances, and then all of a sudden, like, you're sort of untangled and you're by yourself, and it can be very daunting to get started, and that's why a good divorce and having the right advice, the right financial advice, the right legal advice is massively crucial. You shouldn't skimp on that. You know, it might cost money, but it could cost you much more money down the long run if one half of the couple is more clued up on money than the other half, and the other half just signs away without really kind of poring over all of the financial details. And it sounds boring when you put it like that, the finer financial details, but it could be something that, you know, either makes or breaks you for the rest of your life. And you really do need to consider it. But, you know, you need to assess where you're at when you're rebuilding your finances, as soon as you're divorced. You know, you want to see what you've got in place in terms of assets and things, and whether what you have suits your current need. I mean, you know, you said 40s, 50s, 60s. I think there's an ever increasing number of people in their 30s getting divorced as well. And you need to see where you're at. I know it's bleak stuff, but you know, it happens. And lots of people just immediately think of the property, and they just get really, really like tunnel vision, the property. We're just so obsessed with property in this country that I think that's long and old. That's what people think about. How are we going to split this house? How can we cut it in half? You know, and it's like, you might have children, and when there's children involved, it gets even messier and more difficult, and it might be a family home, and you might not want to move your children out of it. There's so many variables. There's so many things to consider. But you know, it's the classic financial sort of mantras, really. Once the divorce is done, you know, making sure you have that emergency savings pot always at hand, which is typically 3 to 6 months of your income if you're working. And it's any debts, thinking about selling that, and all the boring stuff that you might not have got involved in before. The getting insurance, getting the water bills, electricity bills, all those kind of things, all these ducks in a row can be a daunting thing. But at the same time, if you're getting divorced, you're probably getting divorced for a reason. And these things shouldn't be too scary. You just got to make a list, tackle them, see where you go from there. But yeah, it's a difficult one to talk about, Julia.
It is a difficult one. I wrote an article about it, a bit of advice. Don't use your lawyer as a counsellor. They're on a clock. Find a good mate, or indeed a counsellor, that you can work through some of those issues with. But it's worth it because it can be quite an emotional time.
I genuinely think that's a really good piece of advice, because it's like a lot of things in life. You know, lots of things are emotional, and there's not much more emotional than a divorce. But when it comes to money, you should not be emotional. You know, we're told don't be emotional with your money. And if you're going and spending time with a lawyer, mediator, or whoever, they do not want to hear about why your marriage broke down. They do not want to hear all of the ins and outs of everything. Just keep it really focused.
Well, they might do, but it's going to be expensive. Yeah.
Tell me about your divorce, Georgie. Exactly. I've got all the time in the world at £300 a
week. Exactly, yeah. Right.
It's kind of, you know, at the end of the day, you just want to make sure you get your finances in order. As you say, all of the kind of nitty, horrible, gritty of stuff that's happened in your marriage, leave that for the pub and your mates.
Indeed. Good advice. Talking of advice, at This Is Money HQ, you have been digesting yet another manic year of personal finance. So before we really go with some gusto into 2024, now is a good time to review last year's wins and mistakes. Lee, you've pulled together 23 from yourself and your team. Obviously, we won't go through them all because we're a bit limited on time here. And also, people can read the article. But what are the key ones that you would take into 2024 and the ones that you'll leave firmly behind in 2023? Before we do that, Helen, I want to know, what is your number one thing for 2024 that you will take in and the one you will leave behind, you personally?
Oh, Georgie, that's a really big tricky question.
Yeah, I know.
Okay, so for me, I am, fingers crossed, absolutely hopefully, going to buy my first flat in 2024. So it's going to be, fingers crossed, you know, we're not saying definitely, we never know what's going to happen, but if all goes well, I'll finally be getting on the property ladder. I am quite terrified. And that's as someone who actually knows quite a lot about like the property market and mortgages. So I think it's what I'm kind of worried about is going from, you know, having this deposit, which I saved for years and years and years, and then going from having all this money, I mean, it's not that much, but having a pot of money to then giving all that money away and starting with like absolutely no money. So I think my priority now is thinking I need to start building up savings again before I do that. That's my, get saving again. Don't, because I think, you know, when you're saving so long for one goal, you just kind of always think, well, right, I'm putting X amount a month away, you know, this is a sort of foregone conclusion. I think what's going to be really important for me is starting to save again, but without necessarily a big goal in mind, just saving for, as you said before, having that 3 to 6 month pot to keep yourself ticking over. I think I need to not let that get away from me next year is my most important thing.
So the behavior then that's going to help you achieve that you did last year, and the one that's distracting you. So for me, I've got, one of my pros from last year is I kept, even though I want to also buy a house and save for a deposit, I kept sticking money away with the pension. So I was pleased with that. I really went for that and the other savings pots. And I opened some premium bonds. We'll get to that in a sec. Cons, oh my God, I went through all my subscriptions. Lee, you would have had a heart attack. Oh, I was honestly, you name it, especially for like newspapers and magazines and stuff, I had it. Honestly, Lee's face, because I've got a few bank accounts. So it was like coming out a different one. So I wasn't quite sure how many I got. So that sort of behavior, Helen, that's got to go. So I've cancelled at least quite a lot, about £1,000 so far of subscriptions, Helen.
Yeah, I agree. I think blind loyalty to firms kind of has to go. So just right at the end of last year, I finally switched my mobile phone contract. I've been with the same network since I was like 16 years old, so long.
Wow.
And I just never, ever switched. I was like, you know, it's fine. They probably all cost about the same. Turns out they absolutely do not. So I switched to another net, one of the kind of new, smaller networks. It's absolutely great. I'm paying less than half what I was paying with my old network, and I get more data, and it's on a shorter contract. It's absolutely, I'd recommend it to anyone. It's been brilliant. So I thought I need to not stick with companies that aren't
and that's from
me well.
Crane on the case. My goodness me, that is from the woman who should really, Lee, honestly, Lee's itching to get in on this conversation because he can't bear listening to us and our bad behavior as he's there in his gilet and massive jumper. There's no such thing as bad weather, only bad clothes. Lee, you wrote this article, so hit me with at least some of the 23 that you and the team came up with. I reckon it's just you though. You did it all, didn't you?
I can't believe you've fallen into the subscription trap, Georgie. I thought that, you know, you'd be really on top of it. You'd have a spreadsheet and it was all kind of organised.
No, you didn't, you liar.
Oh, oh dear. And actually, on the mobile phone front, I think a lot of people actually do fall into that trap. They take out a two-year contract, for example, pay off the handset and then just don't do anything and carry on paying an absolute fortune where you can just switch to a SIM-only deal and basically shave probably three quarters off your bill. You know, these sort of things you've definitely just got to go and do. But yeah, with 23 tips... No, they weren't all for me, Georgie. 23 things I learned last year, or 23 things I'll keep doing. I mean, my number one thing this year is just to do nothing again, which is essentially I've got investing, I've got premium bonds, I've got I've maxed out my pension, all those kind of things. I've already acted and done it. So if you're listening to this going, God, Lee, you're so smug, stop it. It's just that, you know, a couple
of years ago.
You'd
be right.
I had some financial resolutions a good few years ago and I've just stuck with them. You know, it comes out of my account, don't worry about it. Drip invest into stocks and shares, you know, pension, as I say, maxed out, premium bonds. I won, Lee.
I thought it was a scam because I only started in September and I got a thing say you're a winner. And I thought, ooh.
How much you win? £1 million?
No, because they'd already announced that. But then a little bit later, they announced you're a winner. I won £50. I've only got like £5,000 in there.
Only are five they... grand? All right, Georgie.
I know, but like, no, I don't
that's
have the
5
50.
Grand just sitting around in my premium bonds account.
That was my thing, to get some savings going last year.
Fair enough. So,
yeah, £50. Boom. It wasn't a scam.
I've had a grand total of zero wins since I've had premium bonds in the last sort of 18 months. Oh. Zero. And I don't hold a much different amount than you do.
Oh.
So one of my things is don't bank on premium bond wins. don't think you're gonna get a rate of return, because my rate of return is 0%. And if I put the money into a savings account, a regular savings account at the start of last year, so a fixed account, easy access account, I would have got at least a few hundred quid interest off the higher rate. So premium bonds, don't bank on them. Talking about investing. So stocks and shares, I've just left that away. We had a bit of a horrible year in 2022 with it. 2023, didn't touch anything, didn't do anything different with it. And now I'm just in a massive sea of green, all ticking higher. So just goes to show you don't cash it all out because you've had a bad year. Just keep going with it. But also, I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, or I might not have done. I do have a tangible investment. I like to have an investment, something that I can hold in my hand. It's not just numbers on a screen that you can't see doing anything. So a good few years ago, I started investing in Nintendo products. Now, bear with me here. What I'm talking about is sort of like retro gaming and consoles and that kind of thing. And all of this stuff is just shooting up in value. It's becoming rarer and rarer. So I've been sort of collecting Super Nintendo stuff, N64 stuff. And some of the things I've bought have absolutely rocketed in price from a few years ago. I went to the London Retro Gaming Market in November. It was the busiest event I've ever been to in my life, which I think shows just how much interest there is in this little niche subset of kind of collectibles, right? And it doesn't make up more than 1-2% of my portfolio, but it got me thinking, right? There must be stuff that you could buy now that you buy one to use, like play with and do whatever you want to do with it, and one that you just lock away, box, mint condition. Because some of these mint condition retro games go for thousands and thousands of pounds. You almost want to go in a time machine and say, you know, because what most kids do when they get a new game or whatever, you rip the box open, the manual, I don't think that'll just learn it as I go along, you know, and it all gets destroyed. So I think the one for now and one for keeps thing is a great little thing to sort of think about. Remember, and talking about games and kids and stuff, I remember mentioning this to you, Georgie. I went to a maths lesson. My daughter started primary school in September, and I was in this maths lesson. So it's to learn how to carry on the maths at home and how they're sort of being taught numbers and all that kind of stuff. And at the very end of it, they were talking about money, physical money. So my ears obviously pricked up, you know. I was at the back of the class, but my ears are pricked up by this point. And they were saying that most children play shops at school, but they always go to pretend to tap a card on the machine rather than actually play with physical money. And the teacher said, you know, we're kind of thinking about phasing out the kind of money part of the maths thing. And I was like, whoa, no, what? You know, coins, notes, that kind of thing, play notes. So I've got it all at home. We do it anyway. And then on my daughter's birthday, just a couple of weeks after that maths lesson, I gave her £100 in cash, my wife and I, to take to Smith's Toys Superstores. Now, if you've ever been to Smith's Toys Superstores, you'll be, it's an explosion of toys from bottom to top. But she had £100 cash, and I went round, Georgie, I'm going to tell you this, confidence, and all our listeners, with a calculator. And I told Britt that she'd go around first of all, have a look at what she liked, and then we went around and I showed her how to budget. She had £100 and I'm saying, well, if you get this for 20 quid and this and this and this. And I really feel she grasped it. So teaching kids about money. And I think the last one, because obviously there were a lot in here, but comparing, right? So we have become a nation used to comparing things like insurance, yeah? And I think we kind of had it rammed down our throats so much in the last decade that we've all become a little bit sort of numb to it and whatever. But last year, the rate of insurance, the renewal quotes, the percentage rises, huge motoring and home for me. And I'm going to say the majority of people in this country seeing insurance costs absolutely rocket to the point where I couldn't even negotiate a lower price with the insurer last year. Insurers that we've been with for a decade or more, there was no wriggle room whatsoever, even though nothing had changed. The only thing that had changed is that the car's done more miles on the clock, so it's worth less. You know, doesn't make any sense to me. Anyway, it's gonna be another year of renewal quotes. I think I've just comparing on comparison websites, because just had the car insurance quote land through the mat, up another absolutely astronomical amount with the new insurer that we only signed up with last year. So, you know, do not digest and accept the renewal quote. Give them a call. They're gonna tell you they can't do anything about it, but you're gonna have to move again if you don't want to get booked off. You know, so much for getting rid of the loyalty penalty and all of that. Absolute nonsense. Anyway, I'm going to stop now.
Lee, I fell into that trap. Can you believe it? How many years have I been a finance journalist? Yep. I think it was home insurance. Get a little diary and write down when your subscriptions and your all sorts are up. Also, Lee, because I am the queen of multitasking, when you said there about your Nintendo, obviously listeners to the podcast will know this, that you collect that. I also collect sporting memorabilia, and I was like, I wonder how much my 1972 Munich Olympic Dartington tankard costs, brand new, by the way, in its original packaging. Yeah, 1999. That's probably less than how much it originally cost. Although they're used on eBay, so I'm hoping it's a little bit more. And I've got a couple more of them, so maybe anybody wants the set, like the 1981 FA Cup tankard as well.
Hold on, are you trading or are you selling?
And if anyone wants a bike and a gold sparkly dress, just get in contact on... Anyway, Lee, that's it for this week. Thank you so much. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. If you have any comments or questions, team, anything you'd like them to look into, or also any financial goals, like Lee, who set them a few years ago and just is ticking along nicely, or Helen and I, who have our own financial goals, let us know what they are, Lee.
Yeah, and also if you've won big on the premium bonds, please let us know, because I really am. I'm after someone that's won a sizable amount of money to tell us their story. No one has ever.
Lee, I won 50 quid. So my story is I basically just put some money in premium bonds and I got 50 quid.
Nah, I want, if you've won a million,
or
100 grand, I want to know anonymously, obviously. You can get in touch with us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can X us at This Is Money, and you can also comment where this podcast lives in the comment section. You can talk all about how much you love the podcast.
Indeed. And if you do love the podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.